Chapter 7. The Continuity of Consciousness. Human life runs its course in three alternating states or conditions, namely waking, dreaming sleep, and dreamless sleep. The attainment of the higher knowledge of spiritual worlds can be readily understood if a conception be formed of the changes occurring in these three conditions as experienced by one seeking such higher knowledge. When no training has been undertaken to attain this knowledge, human consciousness is continually interrupted by the restful intervals of sleep. During these intervals, the soul knows nothing of the outer world, and equally little of itself. Only at certain periods, dreams emerge from the deep ocean of insensibility, dreams linked to the occurrences of the outer world or the conditions of the physical body. At first, dreams are only regarded as a particular manifestation of sleep life, and thus only two states are generally spoken of, namely, sleeping and waking. For spiritual science, however, dreams have an independent significance apart from the other two conditions. In the foregoing chapter, a description was given of the alteration ensuing in the dream life of the person undertaking the ascent to higher knowledge. His dreams lose their meaningless, irregular, and disconnected character, and form themselves more and more into a world of law and order. With continued development, not only does this new world, born out of the dream world, come to be in no way inferior to outer physical reality as regards its inner truth, but facts reveal themselves in it, representing a higher reality in the fullest sense of the word. Secrets and riddles lie concealed everywhere in the physical world. In the latter, the effects are seen of certain higher facts, but no one can penetrate to the causes whose perception is confined merely to his senses. These causes are partly revealed to the student in the condition described above and developed out of dream life, a condition, however, in which he by no means remains stationary. True, he must not regard these revelations as actual knowledge, so long as the same things do not also reveal themselves during ordinary waking life. But in time he achieves this as well. He develops this faculty of carrying over into waking consciousness the condition he created for himself out of dream life. Thus, something new is introduced into the world of his senses that enriches it. Just as a person born blind and successfully operated upon will recognize the surrounding objects as enriched by all that the eye perceives, so too will anyone having become clairvoyant in the above manner perceive the whole world surrounding him, peopled with new qualities, things, beings, and so forth. He now need no longer wait for his dreams to live in another world, but he can, at any suitable moment, put himself into the above condition for the purpose of higher perception. This condition then acquires a significance for him similar to the perception in ordinary life of things with active senses as opposed to inactive senses. It can truly be said that the student opens the eyes of his soul and beholds things which necessarily remain concealed from the bodily senses. Now this condition is only transitional to still higher stages of knowledge. If the student continues his esoteric exercises, he will find in due time that the radical change, as described above, does not confine itself to his dream life, but that this transformation also extends to what was previously a condition of deep, dreamless sleep. Isolated conscious experiences begin to interrupt the complete insensibility of this deep sleep. Perceptions previously unknown to him emerge from the pervading darkness of sleep. It is, of course, not easy to describe these perceptions, for our language is only adapted to the physical world, and therefore only approximate terms can be found to express what does not at all belong to that world. Still, such terms must be used to describe the higher worlds, and this is only possible by the free use of simile. Yet seeing that everything in the world is interrelated, the attempt may be made. The things and beings of the higher worlds are closely enough related to those of the physical world to enable, with a little goodwill, some sort of conception of these higher worlds to be formed, even though words suitable for the physical world are used. Only the reader must always bear in mind that such descriptions of supersensible worlds must, to a large extent, be in the nature of simile and symbol. The words of ordinary language are only partially adopted in the course of esoteric training. For the rest, the student learns another symbolical language as a natural outcome of his ascent to higher worlds. The knowledge of this language is acquired during esoteric training itself, but that does not preclude the possibility of learning something concerning the higher worlds, even from such ordinary descriptions as those here given. Some idea can be given of those experiences which emerge from the insensibility of deep sleep, if they be compared to a kind of hearing. We may speak of perceptible tones and words. While the experiences during dreaming sleep may fitly be designated as a kind of vision, the facts observed during deep sleep may be compared to auricular impressions. Parenthesis, it should be remarked in passing that for the spiritual world, too, the faculty of sight remains the higher. There, too, colors are higher than sounds and words. The student's first perceptions in this world do not yet extend to the higher colors, but only to the lower tones. Only because man, according to his general development, is already more qualified for the world revealing itself in dreaming sleep, does he at once perceive colors there. He is less qualified for the higher world unveiling itself in deep sleep. Therefore, the first revelations of it he receives are in tones and words. Later on, he can hear, too, ascend to colors and forms. End of parenthesis. Now, when these experiences during deep sleep first come to the notice of the student, his next task must be to sense them as clearly and vividly as possible. At first, this presents great difficulty, the perception of these experiences being exceedingly slight. The student knows very well on waking that he has had an experience, but is completely in the dark as regards its nature. The most important thing during this initial stage is to remain quiet and composed, and not for a moment lapse into any unrest or impatience. The latter is under all circumstances detrimental. It can never accelerate development, but only delays it. The student must cultivate a quiet and yielding receptivity for the gift that is presented to him. All violence must be repressed. Should he at any period not become aware of experiences during sleep, he must wait patiently until this is possible. Someday this moment will assuredly arrive, and this perceptive faculty, if awaited with patience and composure, remains a secure possession, while should it appear momentarily in answer to forcible methods, it may be completely lost for a long time. Once this perceptive faculty is acquired and the experiences during sleep are present to the student's consciousness in complete lucidity and clarity, his attention should be directed to the following point. All these experiences are seen to consist of two kinds, which can be clearly distinguished. The first kind will be totally different from anything that he has ever experienced. These experiences may be a source of joy and edification, but otherwise they should be left to themselves for the time being. They are the first harbinger of higher spiritual worlds in which the student will find his way later on. In the other kind of experiences, the attentive observer will discover a certain relationship with the ordinary world in which he lives. The subjects of his reflections during life, what he would like to understand in these things around him, but cannot understand with the ordinary intellect, these are the things concerning which the experiences during sleep give him information. During everyday life, man reflects on his environment. His mind tries to conceive and understand the connection existing between things. He seeks to grasp in thought and idea what his senses perceive. It is to these ideas and concepts that the experiences during sleep refer. Obscure, shadowy concepts become sonorous and living in a way comparable only to the tones and the words of the physical world. It seems to the student ever more and more as though the solution of the riddles over which he ponders is whispered to him in tones and words out of a higher world. And he is able to connect with ordinary life whatever comes to him from a higher world. What was formerly only accessible to his thought now becomes actual experience, just as living and substantial as an experience in this physical world can be. The things and beings of this physical world are by no means only what they appear to be for physical perception. They are the expression and effluence of a spiritual world. This spiritual world, hitherto concealed from the student, now resounds for him out of his whole environment. It is easy to see that this higher perceptive faculty can prove a blessing only if the opened soul senses are in perfect order, just as the ordinary senses can only be used for a true observation of the world if their equipment is regular and normal. Now, man himself forms these higher senses through the exercises indicated by spiritual science. The latter include concentration, in which the attention is directed to certain definite ideas and concepts connected with the secrets of the universe, and meditation, which is a life in such ideas, a complete submersion in them in the right way. By concentration and meditation, the student works upon his soul and develops within it the soul organs of perception. While thus applying himself to the task of concentration and meditation, his soul grows within his body, just as the embryo child grows in the body of the mother. When the isolated experiences during sleep begin, as described, the moment of birth is approaching for the liberated soul, for she has literally become a new being, developed by the individual within himself from seed to fruit. The effort required for concentration and meditation must therefore be carefully and accurately maintained, for it contains the laws governing the germination and fruition of the higher human soul being. The latter must appear at its birth as a harmonious, well-proportioned organism. Through an error in following the instructions, no such normal being will come to existence in the spiritual spheres, but a miscarriage, incapable of life. That this higher soul being should be born during deep sleep will be easily grasped, for if that delicate organism, lacking all power of resistance, chanced to appear during physical everyday life, it could not prevail against the harsh and powerful processes of this life. Its activity would be of no account against that of the body. During sleep, however, when the body rests in as far as its activity is dependent on sense perception, the activity of the higher soul, at first so delicate and inconspicuous, can come into evidence. Here again, the student must bear in mind that these experiences during sleep may not be regarded as fully valid knowledge, so long as he is not in a position to carry over his awakened higher soul into waking consciousness as well. The acquisition of this faculty will enable him to perceive the spiritual world in its own character, among and within the experiences of the day. That is, the hidden secrets of his environment will be conveyed to his soul as tones and words. Now, the student must realize at this stage of development that he is dealing with separate and more or less isolated spiritual experiences. He should therefore become aware of constructing out of them a complete whole, or even a connected system of knowledge. In this case, all manner of fantastic ideas and conceptions would be mixed into the soul world, and a world might thus easily be constructed which had nothing to do with the real spiritual world. The student must continually practice self-control. The right thing to do is to strive for an ever clearer conception of the isolated real experiences, and to await the spontaneous arrival of new experiences which will connect themselves, as though of their own accord, with those already recorded. By virtue of the power of the spiritual world, into which he has now found his way, and through continued application to the prescribed exercises, the student experiences an ever-increasing extension and expansion of consciousness during sleep. The unconscious intervals during sleep life grow ever smaller, while more and more experiences emerge from erstwhile unconsciousness. These experiences thus link themselves together increasingly of their own accord, without this true unity being disturbed by all manner of combinations and inferences, which in any case would only originate in an intellect accustomed to the physical world. Yet the less the habits of thought acquired in the physical world are allowed to play into these higher experiences, the better it is. By thus conducting himself, the student approaches ever nearer to the attainment of that condition on his path to higher knowledge, in which the unconsciousness of sleep life is transformed into complete consciousness. When his body rests, man lives in surroundings which are just as real as those of his waking daily life. It is needless to say that the reality during sleep is different from physical reality surrounding the physical body. The student learns, indeed, he must learn if he is to retain a firm footing in the physical world and not become a visionary, to connect the higher experiences of sleep with his physical environment. At first, however, the world entered during sleep is a completely new revelation. This important stage of development, at which consciousness is retained in the life during sleep, is known in spiritual science as the continuity of consciousness. The condition here indicated is regarded, at a certain stage of development, as a kind of ideal, attainable at the end of a long path. What the student first learns is the extension of consciousness into two soul states, in the first of which only disordered dreams were previously possible, and in the second only unconscious dreamless sleep. Anyone having reached this stage of development does not cease experiencing and learning during those intervals when the physical body rests, and when the soul receives no impressions through the instrumentality of the senses. End of chapter 7. Chapter 8. The splitting of the human personality during spiritual training. During sleep, no impressions are conveyed to the human soul through the instrumentality of the physical sense organs. The impressions from the ordinary outer world do not find their way to the soul when in that condition. In certain respects, the soul is actually outside that part of the human being, the so-called physical body, which, in waking life, is the medium for sense perceptions and thought. The soul is then only connected with the finer bodies, parenthesis, the etheric body and the astral body, parenthesis, which are beyond the scope of physical sense observation. But the activity of these finer bodies does not cease during sleep. Just as the physical body is connected and lives with the things and beings of the physical world, affecting them and being affected by them, so too does the soul live in a higher world. Only this life of the soul continues also during sleep. The soul is in full activity during sleep, but we can know nothing of this activity so long as we have no spiritual organs of perception through which to observe what is going on around us and see what we ourselves are doing during sleep, as we observe our daily physical environment with our ordinary senses. The preceding chapters have shown that esoteric training consists in the development of such spiritual sense organs. Now, if, as a result of esoteric training, the student's life during sleep is transformed in the manner described in the foregoing chapter, he will, when in that condition, be able to follow consciously everything going on around him. He can at will find his way in his environment as he could when awake with his ordinary senses. It should here be noted that a higher degree of clairvoyance is required for the higher perception of ordinary physical environment. This was indicated in the last chapter. In the initial stages of his development, the student perceives things pertaining to another world, without being able to discern their connection with the objects of his daily physical environment. These characteristics of life during sleep, or in dreams, illustrate what is continually taking place in the human being. The soul lives in uninterrupted activity in the higher worlds, ever gathering from them the impulse to act upon the physical body. Ordinarily unconscious of his higher life, the esoteric student renders himself conscious of it, and thereby his whole life becomes transformed. As long as the soul remains unseeing in the higher sense, it is guided by superior cosmic beings. And just as the life of a person born blind is changed through a successful operation from its previous dependence on a guide, so too is the life of a person changed through esoteric training. He outgrows the principle of being guided by a master and must henceforward undertake to be his own guide. The moment this occurs, he is, of course, liable to commit errors totally unknown to ordinary consciousness. He acts now from a world from which, formerly, higher powers unknown to him influenced him. These higher powers are directed by the universal cosmic harmony. The student withdraws from this cosmic harmony and must now himself accomplish things which were hitherto done for him without his cooperation. It is for this reason that so much is found in books dealing with these matters concerning the dangers connected with the ascent into higher worlds. The descriptions sometimes given of these dangers may well make timid souls shudder at the prospect of this higher life. Yet the fact is that dangers only arise when the necessary precautions are neglected. If all the measures counseled by true esoteric science are adopted, the ascent will indeed ensue through experiences surpassing in power and magnitude everything the boldest flights of sense-bound fantasy can picture. And yet there can be no question of injury to health or life. The student meets with horrible powers threatening life at every turn and from every side. It will even be possible for him to make use of certain forces and beings existing beyond physical perception, and the temptation is great to control these forces for the furtherance of personal and forbidden interests, or to employ them wrongly out of his deficient knowledge of the higher worlds. Some of these especially important experiences, for instance, the meeting with the guardian of the threshold, will be described in the following chapters. Yet we must realize that the hostile powers are nonetheless present, even though we know nothing of them. It is true that in this case, their relation to man is ordained by higher powers, and that this relation alters when the human being consciously enters this world hitherto concealed from him. But at the same time, his own existence is enhanced, and the circle of his life enriched by a great and new field of experience. A real danger can only arise if the student, through impatience or arrogance, assumes too early a certain independence with regard to the experiences of the higher worlds. If he cannot wait to gain really sufficient insight into the supersensible laws. In these spheres, modesty and humility are far less empty words than in ordinary life. If the student possesses these qualities in the very best sense, he may be certain that his ascent into the higher world will be achieved without danger to all that is commonly called health and life. Above all things, no disharmony must ensue between the higher experiences and the events and demands of everyday life. Man's task must be entirely sought for on this earth, and anyone desiring to shirk his earthly task and to escape into another world may be certain he will never reach his goal. Yet what the senses perceive is only part of the world, and it is in the spirit world that the beings dwell who express themselves in the facts of the physical world. Man must become a partaker of the spirit in order to carry its revelations into the physical world. He transforms the earth by implanting in it what he has ascertained in the spiritual world. That is his task. It is only because this physical world is dependent upon the spiritual, and because man can work upon earth in a true sense only if he is a participator in those worlds in which the creative forces lie concealed. Only for these reasons should he have the desire to ascend to the higher worlds. No one approaching esoteric training with these sentiments, and resolved not to deviate for a moment from these prescribed directions, need fear the slightest danger. No one should allow the prospect of these dangers to deter him from esoteric training. It should rather act as a strong challenge to one and all to acquire those faculties which every true esoteric student must possess. After these preliminary observations that should dispel any element of terror, a description of some of the so-called dangers will be given. It is true that great changes take place in the student's finer bodies, as described above. These changes are connected with certain processes in the development of the three fundamental forces of the soul, with willing, feeling, and thinking. Before esoteric training, these forces are subject to a connection ordained by higher cosmic laws. Man's willing, feeling, and thinking are not arbitrary. A particular idea arising in the mind is attended by a particular feeling, according to natural laws, or it is followed by a resolution of the will in equally natural sequence. We enter a room, find it stuffy, and open the window. We hear our name called and follow the call. We are questioned, and we answer. We perceive an ill-smelling object and experience a feeling of disgust. These are simple connections between thinking, feeling, and willing. When we survey human life, we find that everything is built up on such connections. Indeed, life is not termed normal unless such a connection, founded on the laws of human nature, is observed between thinking, feeling, and willing. It would be found contrary to these laws if the sight of an ill-smelling object gave anyone pleasure, or if anyone, on being questioned, did not answer. The success anticipated from a right education or fitting instruction is based upon the presumption that a connection between thinking, feeling, and willing, corresponding to human nature, can be established in the pupil. Certain ideas are conveyed to him on the assumption that they will be associated in regular fashion with his feelings and volitions. All this arises from the fact that in the finer soul vehicles of man, the central points of the three forces, thinking, feeling, and willing, are connected with each other according to laws. This connection in the finer soul organism has its counterpart in the coarser physical body. In the latter, too, the organs of will are connected according to laws with those of thinking and feeling. Particular thought, therefore, inevitably evokes a feeling or an activity of will. In the course of higher development, the threads interconnecting the three fundamental forces are severed. At first, this severance occurs only within the finer soul organization, but at a still higher stage of the separation extends also to the physical body. It is a fact that in higher spiritual development, the brain divides into three separate parts. This separation is not physically perceptible in the ordinary way, nor can it be demonstrated by the keenest instruments. Yet it occurs, and the clairvoyant has means of observing it. The brain of the higher clairvoyant divides into three independently active entities, the thought brain, the feeling brain, and the will brain. Thus the organs of thinking, feeling, and willing become individualized. Their connection henceforth is not maintained by laws inherent in themselves, but must be managed by the awakened higher consciousness of the individual. This then is the change which the student observes coming over him, that no connection arises of itself between an idea and a feeling or a will impulse, unless he himself provides one. No impulse urges him from thought to action, unless he himself, in freedom, gives rise to this impulse. He can henceforth confront, devoid of feeling, a fact which before his training would have filled him with glowing love or bitter hatred, and he can remain impassive at a thought which formerly would have spurred him on to action as though of its own accord. He can perform actions through resolutions of the will for which there is not the slightest reason for anyone not having undergone esoteric training. The student's great achievement is the attainment of complete mastery over the combined activity of the three soul forces. But at the same time, the responsibility for this activity is placed entirely in his own hands. It is only through this transformation of his being that the student can enter consciously into relation with certain supersensible forces and beings, for his own soul forces are related to certain fundamental forces of the world. The force, for instance, inherent in the will can affect definite things and beings of the higher worlds, and also perceive them, but it can only do so when liberated from its connection with thinking and feeling within the soul. The moment this connection is severed, the activity of the will can be exteriorized. The same applies to the forces of thinking and feeling. A feeling of hatred sent out by a person is visible to the clairvoyant as a fine, luminous cloud of special coloring, and the clairvoyance can ward off this feeling of hatred just as an ordinary person wards off a physical blow that is aimed at him. In the supersensible world, hatred becomes a visible phenomenon, but the clairvoyant can only perceive it insofar as he is able to project outwards the force lying in his feeling, just as the ordinary person directs outward the receptive faculty of his eye. And what is said of hatred applies also to far more important phenomena of the physical world. The student can enter into conscious intercourse with them thanks to the liberation of the fundamental forces of his soul. Through the separation of the forces of thinking, feeling, and willing, the possibility of a threefold aberration arises for anyone neglecting the injunctions given by esoteric science. Such an aberration can occur if the connecting threads are severed before the higher consciousness is sufficiently advanced to hold the reins and guide properly the separated forces into free and harmoniously combined activity. For as a rule, the three human soul forces are not equally advanced in their development at any given period of life. In one person, thinking is ahead of feeling and willing. In a second, another full soul force has the upper hand over its companions. As long as the connection between the soul forces is maintained, as established by higher cosmic laws, no injurious irregularity in a higher sense can occur through the predominance of one force or another. Predominating will, for instance, is prevented by the leveling influence of thinking and feeling from lapsing into any particular excesses. When, however, a person of such predominating will undertakes esoteric training, feeling and thinking cease to exert their regular influence on the will, when the latter constantly presses on to great exertions of power. If then such a person is not sufficiently advanced to control completely the higher consciousness and himself restore harmony, the will pursues its own unbridled way, continually overpowering its possessor. Feeling and thought lapse into complete impotence. The individual is scourged by his overmastering will. A violent nature is the result, rushing from one unbridled action to another. A second deviation occurs when feeling unduly shakes off its proper control. A person inclined to the revering of others may then diverge into unlimited dependence, to the extent of losing all personal will and thought. Instead of higher knowledge, the most pitiful vacuity and feebleness would become such a person's lot. Or in the case of such inordinate predominance of the feeling life, a person with an inclination toward religious devotion can sink into the most degenerate welter. The third evil is found when thought predominates, resulting in a contemplative nature hostile to life and locked up within itself. The world for such people has no further importance save that it provides them with objects for satisfying their boundless thirst for wisdom. No thought ever moves them to an action or a feeling. They appear everywhere as cold and unfeeling creatures. They flee from every contact with the things of ordinary life as though from something exciting their aversion, or which at any rate had lost all meaning for them. These are the three ways of error into which the student can stray. 1. Exuberant violence of will. 2. Sentimental emotionalism. And 3. Cold, loveless striving for wisdom. For outward observation, and also from the ordinary materialistic medical standpoint, anyone thus gone astray is hardly distinguishable, especially in degree, from an insane or at least a highly neurasthenic person. Of course, the student must not resemble these. It is essential for him that the three fundamental soul forces, thinking, feeling, and willing, should have undergone harmonious development before being released from their inherent connection and subordinated to the awakened higher consciousness. For once a mistake is made and one of the soul forces falls a prey to unbridled excess, the higher soul comes into existence as a miscarriage. The unrestrained force pervades the individual's entire personality, and for a long time there can be no question of the balance being restored. What appears to be a harmless characteristic, as long as its possessor is without esoteric training, namely a predominance of thinking or feeling or willing, is so intensified in an esoteric student that the universally human element, indispensable for life, becomes obscured. Yet a really serious danger cannot threaten the student until he has acquired the ability to include in his waking consciousness the experiences forthcoming during sleep. As long as there is only the question of illumination of the intervals of sleep, the life of the senses, regulated by universal cosmic laws, reacts during the waking hours on the disturbed equilibrium of the soul, tending to restore the balance. That is why it is so essential that the waking life of the student should be in every respect regular and healthy. The more capable he is of meeting the demands made by the outer world upon a healthy, sound constitution of body, soul, and spirit, the better it is for him. On the other hand, it may be very bad for him if his ordinary waking life affects him in an exciting or irritating way, that is, if destruction or hampering influences of outer life affect him in addition to the great changes taking place in his inner self. He must seek to find everything corresponding to his powers and faculties which can lead him into undisturbed, harmonious communion with his surroundings, while avoiding everything detrimental to this harmony, everything that brings unrest and feverish haste into his life. And here it is not so much a question of casting off this unrest and haste in an external sense, but much more of taking care that thoughts, feelings, intentions, and bodily health are not thereby exposed to continual fluctuation. All this is not so easy for the student to accomplish as it was before esoteric training, for the higher experiences now playing into his life act upon his entire existence. Should anything within these higher experiences not be as it should, the irregularity continues, lying in wait for him, and may at every turn throw him off the right path. For this reason, the student should omit nothing which can secure for him unfailing mastery over his whole being. He should never be found wanting in presence of mind or in calm penetration of all situations of life. In the main, a genuine esoteric training gives rise of itself to all these qualities, and as it progresses, the student only becomes acquainted with the dangers while simultaneously and at the right moment acquiring the full power to rout them from the field. The end of chapter 8, and I will begin chapter 9, The Guardian of the Threshold. The important experiences marking the student's ascent into the higher worlds include his meeting with the Guardian of the Threshold. Strictly speaking, there are two guardians, a lesser and a greater. The student meets the lesser guardian when the threads connecting willing, feeling, and thinking within the finer astral and etheric bodies begin to loosen in the way described in the foregoing chapter. The greater guardian is encountered when this sundering of the connections extends to the physical parts of the body, that is, at first to the brain. The lesser guardian is a sovereign being. He does not come into existence, as far as the student is concerned, until the latter has reached the requisite stage of development. Only some of his most important characteristics can here be indicated. The attempt will now be made to describe in narrative form this meeting with the lesser guardian of the threshold, as a result of which the student learns that his thinking, feeling, and willing have become released within him from their inherent connection. A truly terrible spectral being confronts him, and he will need all the presence of mind and faith in the security of his path which he has had ample opportunity to acquire in the course of his previous training. The guardian proclaims his signification somewhat in the following words, quote, "Hitherto, powers invisible to thyself watched over thee. They saw to it that in the course of thy lives each of thy good deeds brought its reward, and each of thine evil deeds was attended by its evil results. Thanks to their influence, thy character formed itself out of thy life experiences and thy thoughts. They were the instruments of thy destiny. They ordained the measure of joy and pain allotted to thee in thine incarnations, according to thy conduct in lives gone by. They ruled over thee as the all-embracing law of karma. These powers will now partly release thee from their constraining influence, and henceforth must thou accomplish for thyself a part of the work which hitherto they performed for thee. Destiny struck thee many a hard blow in the past. Thou knewest not why. Each blow was the consequence of a harmful deed in a bygone life. Thou foundest joy and gladness, and thou didst take them as they came. They too were the fruits of former deeds. Thy character shows many a beautiful side, and many an ugly flaw. Thou hast thyself to thank for both, and they are the result of thy previous experiences and thoughts. These were, till now, unknown to thee. Their effects alone were made manifest. The karmic powers, however, beheld all thy deeds in former lives, and all thy most secret thoughts and feelings, and determined accordingly thy present self and thy present mode of life. But now all the good and evil sides of thy bygone lives shall be revealed to thee. Hitherto they were interwoven with thine own being. They were in thee, and thou couldst not see them, even as thou canst not behold thine own brain with physical eyes. But now they become released from thee. They detach themselves from thy personality. They assume an independent form which thou canst see even as thou beholdest the stones and plants of the outer world. And I am that very being who shaped my body out of thy good and evil achievements. My spectral form is woven out of thine own life's record. Till now thou hast borne me invisibly within thee, and it was well that this was so, for the wisdom of thy destiny, though concealed from thee, could thus work within thee. so that the hideous stains on my form should be blotted out. Now that I have come forth from within thee, that concealed wisdom too has departed from thee. It will pay no further heed to thee. It will leave the work in thy hands alone. I must become a perfect and glorious being, or fall a prey to corruption. And should this occur, I would drag thee also down with me into a dark and corrupt world. If thou wouldest avoid this, then thine own wisdom must become great enough to undertake the task of that other, concealed wisdom, which has departed from thee. As a form visible to thyself, I will never for an instant leave thy side, once thou hast crossed my threshold. And in future, whenever thou dost act or think wrongly, thou wilt straightway perceive thy guilt as a hideous, demoniacal distortion of my form. Only when thou hast made good all thy bygone wrongs, and hast so purified thyself that all further evil is, for thee, a thing impossible, only then will my being have become transformed into radiant beauty. Then too shall I again become united with thee for the welfare of thy future activity. Yet my threshold is fashioned out of all the timidity that remains in thee, out of all the dread of the strength needed to take full responsibility for all thy actions and thoughts. As long as there remains in thee a trace of fear of becoming thyself the guide of thine own destiny, just so long will this threshold lack what still remains to be built into it. And as long as a single stone is found missing, just so long must thou remain standing as though transfixed, or else stumble. Seek not then to cross this threshold until thou dost feel thyself entirely free from fear and ready for the highest responsibility. Hitherto I only emerged from thy personality when death recalled thee from an earthly life. But even then my form was veiled from thee. Only the powers of destiny who watched over thee beheld me, and could thus, in the intervals between death and a new birth, build in thee, in accordance with my appearance, that power and capacity thanks to which thou couldst labor in a new earth life at the beautifying of my form for thy welfare and progress. It was I too whose imperfection ever and again constrained the powers of destiny to lead thee back to a new incarnation upon earth. I was present at the hour of thy death, and it was on my account that the lords of karma ordained thy reincarnation. And it is only by thus unconsciously transforming me to complete perfection in ever-recurring earthly lives that thou couldst have escaped the powers of death and passed over into immortality united with me. Visible do I thus stand before thee today, just as I have ever stood invisible beside thee in the hour of death. When thou shalt have crossed my threshold, thou wilt enter those realms to which thou hast hitherto only had access after physical death. Thou dost now enter them with full knowledge, and henceforth, as thou wanderest outwardly, visible upon the earth, thou wilt at the same time wander in the kingdom of death, that is, in the kingdom of life eternal. I am indeed the angel of death, but I am at the same time the bearer of a higher life without end. Through me thou wilt die with thy body still living, to be reborn into an imperishable existence. Into this kingdom thou art now entering. Thou wilt meet beings that are supersensible, and happiness will be thy lot. But I myself must provide thy first acquaintance with that world, and I am thine own creation. Formerly I drew my life from thee, from thine, but now thou hast awakened me to a separate existence, so that I stand before thee as the visible gauge of thy future deeds, perhaps too as thy constant reproach. Thou hast formed me, but by so doing thou hast undertaken as thy duty to transform me. Unquote. Parenthesis. It will be gathered from the above that the guardian of the threshold is an astral figure, revealing itself to the student's awakened higher sight. And it is to this supersensible encounter that spiritual science conducts him. It is a lower magical process to make the guardian of the threshold physically visible also. That was attained by producing a cloud of fine substance, a kind of frankincense resulting from a particular mixture of a number of substances. The developed power of the magician is then able to mold the frankincense into shape, animating it with the still unredeemed karma of the individual. Such physical phenomena are no longer necessary for those sufficiently prepared for the higher sight. And besides this, anyone who sees without adequate preparation his unredeemed karma appear before his eyes as a living creature would run the risk of straying into evil byways. Bulwer Lytton's book Zanoni contains in novel form a description of the guardian of the threshold. What is here indicated in narrative form must not be understood in the sense of an allegory, but as an experience of the highest possible reality befalling the esoteric student. I'm on page 238, the end of the side of the tape. The end of